Good evening. We're swimming in plums tonight. That's wonderful. Different kinds, it looks like.
These ones aren't quite ripe.
I see, I see. Put them in with an apple and they'll get ripe. Thank you. Thank you both. Sharon, it's nice to see you.
It's fun to be here again.
Yay. School is out, eh?
Partly.
Uh-huh.
I'm teaching myself.
Enough to come anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yay. Let's do introductions around just so to sharpen up your memory.
Jan.
Andy.
Yes.
Samia.
Jane.
Brit.
Sharon.
June. Donnie.
Me.
What's your name?
I just got back from the mountains a couple of hours ago, so I'm a little bit unacclimated, I guess, at the moment. Diana was part of the group. There were four women of us, and she asked after all of you and wished she could be here. She had to go back to get back on an airplane. She's probably getting on the plane right this minute and flying back so she can go back to work tomorrow. They had to pull me up the mountain, practically carry me back down the mountain, but we made it. So it's quite an adventure. This is the copy of the Shobo Genzo Zuimon Ki that I was talking about that you can buy in book form. And this is a Thomas Cleary translation. The one you get online, it doesn't attribute the translation, and I don't think it's the same one. I haven't compared them, but I think it's a new and different one.
You're right. It doesn't say who it is, and that's disappointing because it's Kazu Tanahashi, I believe.
Oh, it is?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised.
Sure.
Yes, because he's...
It's not attributed.
Yes. But we have two translations, therefore. We have this one that we can carry around, or we can print out the one online. It's free. The Soto Zen, the Japanese Soto Zen, what it, school, I guess it's called, is publishing all of Shobo Genzo. And I thought I would, and I took this with me in my backpack so that I could select things that throughout that we could look at. But as I read through it, I realized that that would be silly, that we'd be much better off just to read it straight through. Some of it isn't going to be relevant because it's for monks, and he's... outlining a kind of monk-like mind and way of life that we couldn't accomplish even if we wanted to in our own state now. But even so, there's very much that's interesting in here. And all through it, there are very short mentions of Dogen's life and his own comments about his experience. Not as fulsome as Coben's comments are that I've discovered through the transcripts of Coben's talks, but still you get a sense of Dogen as a person in this much more than some of the Shobo Genzo that we've studied. So I'm looking forward to this. So we'll start this next week because we have half of the last bit of Suzuki Roshi. We stopped in the middle. We stopped on 137, I think. Donalyn, I bet you remember because you were the one who suggested it. Perhaps.
Actually, my bookmark's on 135, and I think it was the last paragraph.
Is that what it was? Yes. Oh, good.
On page 135, the paragraph starts with the Zensky.
Yes.
That's it. That's it. You want to start?
The Zen school is based on our actual nature, on our true mind as expressed and realized in practice. Zen does not depend on a particular teaching, nor does it substitute teaching for practice. We practice our Zen to express our true nature, not to attain enlightenment. Bodhidharma's Buddhism is to be practiced, to be enlightenment. At first this may be kind of a belief, but later it is something the student feels or already has. Physical practice and rules are not so easy to understand, maybe especially for Americans. You have an idea of freedom which concentrates on physical freedom, on freedom of activity. This idea causes you some mental suffering and loss of freedom. You think you want to limit your thinking. You think some of your thinking is unnecessary or painful or entangling, but you do not think you want to limit your physical activity. For this reason, Haikujo established the rules and way of Zen life in China. He was interested in expressing and transmitting the freedom of true mind. Zen mind is transmitted on our Zen way of life based on
Haikujo's
rules.
I think we naturally need some way of life as a group and as Zen students in America. And as
Haikujo
established our way of monastic life in China, I think we must establish an American way of Zen life. I'm not saying this jokingly. I am pretty serious. But I do not want to be too serious. If we become too serious, we will lose our way. If we are playing games, we will lose our way. Little by little, with practice and endurance, we must find the way for ourselves, find out how to live with ourselves and with each other. In this way, we will find our precepts. If we practice hard, concentrate on Sazen, and organize our lives so that we can sit well, we will find out what we are doing. But you have to be careful in the rules and way you establish. If it is too strict, you will fail. If it is too loose, the rules will not work. Our way should be strict enough to have authority, an authority everyone should obey. The rules should be possible to observe. This is how Zen tradition was built up, decided little by little, created by us in our practice. We cannot force anything, but once the rules have been decided, we should obey them completely until they are changed. This is not a matter of good or bad, convenient or inconvenient. You just do it without question. That way, your mind is free. The important thing is to obey your rules without discrimination. This way, you will know the pure Zen mind. To have our own way of life means to encourage people to have a more spiritual and adequate way of life as human beings. And I think one day you will have your own practice in America.
The only way to study pure mind is through practice. Our inmost nature wants some medium, some way to express and realize itself. We answer this inmost request through our rules, and patriarch after patriarch shows us his true mind. In this way, we will have an accurate, deep understanding of practice. We must have more experience of our practice. At least we must have some enlightenment experience. You must put confidence in the big mind which is always with you. You should be able to appreciate things as an expression of big mind. This is more than faith. This is ultimate truth which you cannot reject. Whether it is difficult or easy to practice, difficult or easy to understand, you can only practice it. Priest or layman is not the point. To find yourself as someone who is doing something is the point. To resume your actual being through practice. To resume the you which is always with everything, with Buddha, which is fully supported by everything. Right now, you may say it is impossible, but it is possible. Even in one moment, you can do it. It is possible this moment. It is this moment. That you can do it in this moment means you can always do it. So if you have this confidence, this is your enlightenment experience. If you have this strong confidence in your big mind, you are already a Buddhist in the true sense, even though you do not attain enlightenment.
That is why Dogen Zenji said, "Do not expect that all who practice Zazen will attain enlightenment about this mind which is always with us." He meant, if you think that big mind is somewhere outside yourself, outside of your practice, then that is a mistake. Big mind is always with us. That is why I repeat the same thing over and over when I think you do not understand. Zen is not just for the man who can hold his legs or who has great spiritual ability. Everyone has Buddha nature. We each must find some way to realize our true nature. The purpose of practice is to have direct experience of the Buddha nature which everyone has. Whatever you do should be the direct experience of Buddha nature. Buddha nature means to be aware of Buddha nature. Your effort should extend to saving all sentient beings. If my words are not good enough, I'll hit you. Then you will understand what I mean. And if you do not understand me just now, someday you will. Someday someone will understand. I will wait for the island I was told is moving slowly up the coast from Los Angeles to Seattle.
I feel Americans, especially young Americans, have a great opportunity to find out the true way of life for human beings. You are quite free from material things, and you begin Zen practice with a very pure mind, a beginner's mind. You can understand Buddha's teaching exactly as he meant it. But we must not be attached to America or Buddhism or even to our practice. We must have beginner's mind, free from possessing anything. A mind that knows everything is in flowing change. Nothing exists but momentarily in its present form and color. One thing flows into another and cannot be grasped. Before the rain stops, we hear a bird. Even under the heavy snow, we see snowdrops and some new growth. In the east, I saw rhubarb already. In Japan, in the spring, we eat cucumbers.
It's going to hit us.
Watch out. This is lovely. This is quite lovely. So when our fellow student Lori in New Mexico was told that she had 2 to 4 weeks to live and decided to go home rather than try some radical chemo, she said when she got home, she just went straight to the Buddha and bowed down. This is very poetic and beautiful, but it's about the reality of our actual life. which in its beauty includes everything. So his encouragement for us to sit isn't just to make our life better or to give us a sense of freedom so much as it is to really understand what this is right now, as he says. It may not be tomorrow. There may not be a tomorrow. But there's always this. And for the rest, we don't know. That's why our sitting practice is so keen. We sit in the midst of our not knowing. To just be this. To be it completely. When he was talking this talk, he was having no idea about what American Zen was going to be, or even American Buddhism. It was brand new then. He had come to America to serve the Japanese community, and suddenly he found himself with a room full of young Americans wanting to learn how to sit and wanting to know about Buddhism. And as he worked his way through the blooming of the Zen Center, which just grew up right around him, he told everyone that he didn't know what to make of American Zen, that he would just give us the Japanese version. And so Zen Center is left with the Japanese version, which they've been slowly polishing and pruning and adjusting. And I think we'll be doing that for about 500 years at least before we have any real sense of what we're doing in terms of an institution. Maybe we'll get smart and just de-institutionalize it over and over again. Let the institutions slip away and new ones grow up. I don't know. But what we have to work with is Zazen itself. And as he says, we have a few rituals as we're heading towards Sesshin. We can think about the rituals and practice period also, what it is that supports our practice. It gives us ease of mind so that we don't have to concern ourselves so much about how things should be because they're already set. If it becomes a should-be that's driving us, that somebody else is making us do, it doesn't work. But if we accept the way that we all do, then suddenly we're really free. Free to just go along and be carried. Actually, that's what Zazen itself is, going along and being carried. Life is very brief and very sweet. I went on this trip with Connie Batten, whom some of you met. She's the one who lives up on the mountain. She's quite an original person. And she loves the mountains and has always loved them and always spent many, many days up there. And she's taking 6 weeks off. And she took three of us up there. She was the host. Took us to her secret place about 4 miles in and 4 miles up. It was a long, long way, it felt to me. To them it was nothing. The others are younger and stronger than I am. But for me it was a very long way. She brought us down this afternoon and went right back up there to spend the night by herself. Then she's coming down tomorrow to meet another group. And she's going to host another group through the weekend. And then she's going off to be by herself for a month in the mountains. She's been studying Buddhism for a long time, and her feeling was that this was the time to really sit down and be with it in the place where she feels most safe and free. It's a very brave thing to do. It's not that safe, actually. Things can happen, but it's also a completely inspiring kind of place to be in nature where everything is already taking care of itself, you could say. The trees are just being trees. The water is just running in its own way. The little waterfalls falling as they fall. Of course, we can be inspired anywhere, but in the deep, deep, deep nature, we can feel our own deep nature. And there's a kind of peace there. So his ending here. One thing flows into another and cannot be grasped. Before the rain stops, we hear a bird. Even under the heavy snow, we see snowdrops and some new growth. And then he does a very Zen Japanese-y thing. It's just like a Japanese poem. In the east, I saw rhubarb already. In Japan, in the spring, we eat cucumbers. Life goes on, lives itself through us continually, right here, right now. Thank you, Shunryu Suzuki. Are there questions? Jane?
You said the bodhisattva vowed, and you say beings are numberless, I vow to save them. I don't understand what it's saying. He touched on that in this last passage. It feels to say, number one, to say I, and then save them, just seems too willful, maybe, or. It's hard again to use words.
I understand.
We're apart from things.
Yes. And that we're superior and have some power over others, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those things like the trying to understand emptiness, because the English word has so many connotations that it doesn't compute for us very well. The Huineng, when he's translated it or talked about it, he said, "I vow to save the many beings of my mind." So it's not about sitting in some high place, and I don't know even what saving would be, you know, but that whatever comes, we accept. Whatever appears is appearing in our mind as mind. And our tendency is to reject or grab. And the saving means I vow to be with what comes in a neutral way so it can thrive and flourish. So you're right, the I, it can get in the way. In fact, originally there isn't any I in there. It's just beings are numberless, vowing to save them. I can't remember how it goes. And delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to end them. There isn't any I vow. It's just vowing. That our whole being is vowing this thing. Does that make sense?
That helps a lot. It's I was excited. I guess I learned it here, but I'm excited. Yeah, I did learn it. I was excited after sitting, and I kind of use it as a ritual to transition from sitting to
yes,
the day, and that just chops it so much to say I.
Yes.
I'm gonna try that. Soften it with vowing too.
We could all do that. Just leave the I out. But it's tricky because then in English it could be construed in our mind as something out there vowing. You know, that we aren't taking personal responsibility for the vowing. And it does mean that we're taking complete personal responsibility for whatever comes to us. Whatever moves through us.
The thing is, when you're coming from the cushion, though, you're already feeling that. So it's not like I need a...
Yes, that's true.
A spur.
Yes.
It's more like I would like a way of affirming where I feel like I'm sitting.
Yes. Yes. It's our continual dilemma, how we move from one side to the other. We were talking about that in the mountains, this what I call the liminal conundrum of, you know, we move from form to emptiness, it feels like, in our minds. We shift from one view to another view and try not to get stuck anywhere. And you're right, it's whatever it takes, do. Britt, did you have something? You did.
What was Coven's translation of that vow? Was it like the beings will save themselves?
Yes. Yes. Beings are numberless, they will save themselves. Which takes us completely out of the... But that isn't what the original wording was, so he flipped it to make sure that we didn't get stuck there.
Is it possible to get stuck on the notion of beings?
We can get stuck on anything. That's our expertise. Samuel?
My upbringing in Christianity and death is so different than, actually, I don't know what the death concept is in Buddhism. And I know a little about Zen, which I think I've heard you say once that there's not much that we know about it or after death. So is there like a little short recipe for how to prepare yourself or others that are ill?
Well, yes, it's different in different flavors of Buddhism, of course. In Zen, and it's different in different schools of Zen as well. And different teachers have different points of view. There's not one parting line about it at all. In a Zen funeral, the presiding priest raps on the coffin and addresses the corpse saying, "Tathagata, we do not know where we come from. Where you come from, we don't know where you go. Tathagata." So it's about the coming and going of Buddha-ness itself. And each death is a death of an apparent dying of Buddha, and each birth is a new Buddha being born. And if that's the case, then Buddha never dies. Buddha just keeps changing shape. So that when an old Tibetan Lama was dying and his students were all standing around sobbing, he said, "Don't cry." He said, "Nothing happens. Our own coming and going feels so intensely personal. But if we really look into it, all we know is that our own life, present moment life. We don't really know death at all. Death is death. We have no experience of it at all. So we live our life, and as Koban told me, just sit zazen until your death day, and then find out what happens.
Is there literature written about it?
Oh, a lot, a lot. There's the Tibetan Book of Dead, but that's the Tibetan view, which is very complex. Donald, and you probably know better than I do. There's a lot of it.
One of my favorite is Thich Nhat Hanh. Has his sweet way of saying
yes.
Things. And I see the book. I can put it on the list here if you want, or email it to you, but it's, or lend it to you. And there's, he talks about this. It's not that, you know, and he talks about it conversely, you know, how are we born? You know, where are we coming from? And he just looks at this whole coming and going. He calls, what is it called? Birthdays, happy creation days, or something like that. The book is just called Fear of Dying. Death and dying. But, you know, just reading a couple of paragraphs, a couple of chapters is very helpful. And yes, there's something else. Wendy, did you find one that was useful for you?
Well, that Faces of Dying, I can't recall the author's name. He was a hospice worker. That is a nice one too. I can give you that kind too. It's the Pasna student that lived in hospice, and he just had sweet, good stories of, what's this one too?
I can bring it. Thank you very much. Yes.
But didn't Suzuki Roshi write a book on that, The Branching Streams, wasn't it?
It's an analysis, a kind of analysis of a sutra of the Sandokai. But yeah, it's certainly about both sides, you could say, the life-death experience. We should study that one of these days. You think?
I don't know, well, that's the one you said that on the way, you study that one on the way out.
Yeah, right. Well, but we don't know when we're going out, so maybe we better prepare.
It doesn't cause it.
Yes.
Suzuki, he had an interesting story, well, maybe this is another one, like, on his deathbed, he said, I don't want to die.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Very simply.
Very simply, yeah. Yeah, hardly anybody wants to die. I think even suicides, once they've done the deed, they probably say, oh no, I didn't mean it, you know. Wait a minute. It's so strong in us. So strong. Oh, it's after 8. I'm sorry.